He made an abrupt U-turn on Easy Street. His apple cart of greed was overturned so that Maybelline makeup could not mask the portrait of guilt sketched on his face. His gut growled with a gruff voice of self-loathing. Portrait of a bad shepherd whose blackest sheep was his own soul. Portrait of a thief who discovered that he had put his own hand into the cookie jar. What was it that was able to awaken this man's soul? What was it that was able to awaken the still small voice in David? It was the still small voice of Nathan. For you see, Nathan had long been a faithful servant of King David. But even more important, Nathan was a faithful servant of God. He loved God's covenant, he loved God's law, and he knew that David had broken God's heart because he had broken God's law. David murdered his lieutenant Uriah so that he could have his soldier's wife Bathsheba for his own. Bathsheba, with whom he had committed adultery, was now carrying David's child, a child who would not live. This story is at the center of the Davidic narrative in the Old Testament. There is no one we know more about in the Old Testament than David. We have 1 and 2 Samuel that tells his outer life. We have most of the Psalms that were written by King David that tells of his inner life. And here in this story, one that if anyone knows anything about David, this is what you know. We learn something very important. We learn how a godly man can open himself up to the evil one. And when he does that, he allows the devil to wrench ever tighter the vice grip of mortal sin and suffocate grace and virtue in the life of David. Now remember David. As a younger man, we were told that he was a man after God's own heart. We could say that David had a heart of gold. He was obedient and faithful to King Saul, who repeatedly wanted to try to kill him. But David never once tried to usurp Saul's authority. We have the story between David and Jonathan, the greatest story of friendship in the Old Testament. We see the young David as a man of great loyalty, a man who truly did have a heart that was after God's heart. But then he ascended the throne. At first, things went well because David governed being led by virtue. But the more powerful he got, the more influential Israel got so that it became the dominant power in the Middle East, something happened to David that can happen to anyone who is successful. Pride took over. And there's a very telling thing in this story. Pride took over at a particular time of the year. This was a springtime pride, when coupled with greed and envy gripped David's heart. For you see, in the springtime, this was the time when kings usually went to war. And one of the things we know about David's earlier life was he was a good warrior. He was always willing to go in front of his troops. But this year he said, "I'm tired. I'm going to take an afternoon nap." And he was so tired that his nap lasted not 1 hour, not 3 hours, not 4 hours, but it lasted till early evening. And then upon waking from his nap, he stretched and went up onto the roof of his palace to see over there a woman who was bathing by the name of Bathsheba. And rather than taking custody of his eyes, he looked and looked and intensified his gaze. His heart became lustful. His heart became covetous. His heart became envious. St. Augustine says of envy, "It is the diabolical sin," said St. Augustine. "From envy are born hatred, detraction, calumny." Calumny is when you so diminish the character and the reputation of another. He then says this, and this is so interesting. Envy results in an experience of joy caused by the misfortune of a neighbor, and displeasure if someone is prosperous. So joy when they fail, displeasure when they prosper. And what had happened to David was this diabolical sin had so seized his soul that not only did he take Bathsheba and sleep with her, but when he then found out that she was pregnant, he did everything he could to cover up his tracks. He called Uriah back from the front line. He had him over for dinner, one glass of wine, four, five, six. Go sleep with your wife. I can't do that. I'm a man under orders. Next day, David tries a second time. Go sleep with your wife, Bathsheba. No, king. I'm a man under orders. How can I go and sleep with my wife when the fellow troops are at the front line? David realizes he is not going to be able to get Uriah to go to bed with his wife. And so he decides instead, okay, I'm going to send Uriah back to the front line. And here is the most diabolical thing at all. He writes a note, and he seals the note, and he gives it to Uriah and says, go give this note to General Joab. He does. Joab opens the note to these words. Put Uriah in the front lines where the fighting is fiercest. Then pull back and leave him exposed so he is sure to be killed. Soon after, Uriah is killed. Messengers bring back tidings to David that this lieutenant is dead. And now David sends a second note, which is more diabolical than the first. Listen to the words David writes to console Joab, the general. Don't trouble yourself over this. War kills. Sometimes one, sometimes another. You never know who is next. Do you see what's happened to David? Envy, pride, greed, capital sin, deadly sin, had so gotten a hold of his heart that it twisted it to the point that it was almost dead. But not quite. Because soon after this second note is sent to Joab, Nathan the prophet shows up. And when Nathan shows up, he says, King David, can I have a word with you? And I love what he does. I think if I had been Nathan, because I'm not as creative as he is, I would have given it to him straight. But Nathan doesn't do that. Instead, he tells the most beautiful parable that we have in the whole of the Old Testament. What do you think, King? There were two men in the same city, one rich, the other poor. The rich man had huge flocks of sheep and herds of cattle. The poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had brought and raised. It grew up with him and his children. It was like a member of his family. This ewe lamb was so important that she would even go and sleep with the kids. This was like the family pet. Well, one day, the rich man had a traveler drop by. And even though he had fields and fields and fields of sheep, he said, I don't want to use one of my sheep. I'm going to go over to that neighbor. I'm going to take that ewe lamb. I'm going to kill it, and I'm going to serve it to my friend. David hears this story. He explodes with anger. As surely as God lives, says David, the man who did this ought to be lynched. He must repay for the lamb four times over for his crime and for his stinginess. And what comes next is the best one-liner in the whole of the Bible. David, you are that man. And then everything changes. David will be forgiven. But as I'm going to show you now, there are consequences from this story that we all need to think about because they apply to us as well. So what does the David story teach us? often it is crushing for us to discover that a person we admire has real faults. An idealized parent disappoints. A friend we respect falls short. A romantic relationship is influenced by infidelity. A political leader suffers his own particular downfall. A bishop, a priest do not embody the person of Christ. Discouraged and hurt, we feel a bitterness that is hard to overcome. But here's the thing about the biblical record. When we look at the biblical record, we say, God, why do you give us examples like this? Well, here is the answer. And the first thing we need to realize is God is a realist. His book contains, let's pretend and whitewash over these stories. Let's have some sort of kind of picture of believers that is superficial. It's not like that at all. We are called to appreciate the fact that when we come to this God, in spite of our own weaknesses, and God does not overlook the weaknesses, but neither is he crushed by our failures, because as Psalm 103 says, written by King David, he knows that we are dust. So God wants us to be real. Secondly, what we learn here is that it's good that we have people like King David who were told are men after God's own heart. For you see, if the people in the Bible were just so perfect, how could we identify with them? If their lives were so goody-two-shoe, there is no way that we could approach them. Wow, that's a spiritual giant like David or like Abraham or whoever it might be. But when we recognize the narrative shows us that they struggled too, and it was sometimes out of their greatest weaknesses that they experienced mercy, this brings us to a point where we say, that's me. I'm that man. I'm that woman. I see myself in that story. The New Testament affirms in the writing of St. Paul that no temptation has seized you except that is common to all people. Do you see, beloved? We are bound up together in the ties of a shared humanity. David knew the feelings and temptations that you know. They were his as well. When the Bible reports his failures and his follies, it demonstrates a common bond and encourages us to identify our own inner struggle with theirs. And one of the things that's striking about the David story is after this, although he is truly forgiven, he has to live with the temporal consequences of his sin for the rest of his life. That his family from that time on will be gripped by conflict, by dissension, by battles between brothers and sisters. And as you perhaps know, his son Absalom tries to take the throne from him. He does the same thing to David in a sense that David did to Uriah. But here's the most important thing to learn from this story today. Biblical saints and the saints down through the centuries are also shown to be sinners. This is because Scripture expresses something basic about the gospel. The good news of God's love for us is not, trust me, and now you're freed from your humanity. The good news of God's love is that he has committed himself to deal with sin and to progressively make us more and more like him. This is one of the beauties that we have in the Psalms of the Old Testament, because most of the Psalms are written by David himself. And in those prayers, we see the transformation, the conversion that happens in David's life. Here's the thing about David's greatness. It's not his perfection, but it was his willingness to face his sin and to return wholeheartedly to God and to deal with the consequences of sin in his life. In today's gospel, this theme is also on display. There is that woman who comes to Jesus, tears pouring out of her eyes, having that ointment, wiping Jesus's tears, his feet, excuse me, with her hair. Here was a woman who had experienced profoundly the forgiveness of God. And so she was a loving and forgiving person. And here's the great challenge for us all. When we're religious, it is easy to be like Simon the Pharisee. Oh yeah, I know all about forgiveness. I know all about God. But it never touches us. It always remains out there. It never becomes personal. And when that happens, like Simon the Pharisee, we say things like, if only he knew that that person is a sinner. There's no love there. There's no mercy there. What's so interesting about Nathan is he didn't go and point his finger at David like that. He told a parable. He told a story to get David's attention. So in conclusion, we have to hear what St. Paul says in our passage from Galatians today. None of us can justify ourselves before God. Like David, like the woman in Luke 7, we stand before God and plead his mercy. We plead his forgiveness. Such is the theme of today's readings, and indeed such was the theme of the collect I prayed at the beginning of Mass that goes like this. O God, strength of those who hope in you, graciously hear our pleas. And since without you, mortal frailty can do nothing, grant us always the help of your grace. This is what David knew, the help of God's grace. When we choose to live, when we choose to pray like this, we will, like David and the woman in Luke 7, be men, women, teenagers, and children who are people after God's own heart.